The ascendance of Rabbeinu Gershom pointed to a new era when German Jewry assumed its own Torah independence. Rabbeinu Gershom was born, some say in 950, some say in 960. He died 1028 that year, and he was two generations ahead of Rashi. His students were Rashi's Rabbeim. And when he ascended into leadership in Germany, this was the beginning of essentially when Ashkenazi Jewry asserts its independence and they don't feel bound by the Babylonian Gaonim. The Gemara is written in the year 500, and from the 7th to 11th century, essentially the power, for the most part, is in the hands of the Gaonim in Bavel, but starting from the 10th century, you begin to find both independence from Sephardic Rabbonim and Ashkenazic Rabbonim. In the 10th century, that's when you have rabbinic leaders in Spain, in North Africa, who are asserting independence from Bavel, and you have Rabbonim and Ashkenaz in Germany who are asserting independence. And that's when the Ashkenazi and Sephardi communities start to develop. In the times of the Gemara, in the times of the era of the Gaonim, for the most part, there were no Ashkenazim and Sephardim. It was basically the Machlokes, if there was, the debate was between Eretz Yisrael and Bavel, who's correct there. And now, starting from the 10th century, that's when you have Ashkenaz versus Sephard. That's when you begin. And it was Rabbeinu Gershom who really was the first rabbinic leader, the strong rabbinic leader. Again, the Kolonimus family was the first rabbinic family to come to Ashkenaz a little bit before, but the personality of Rabbeinu Gershom really caused the ascent of Ashkenazi Jewry, and Rabbeinu Gershom is probably one of the best examples of the influence attached to a single personality who had so many different outstanding characteristics. Again, he was the Gadol of Chachmei Ashkenaz in Germany before the Crusades. The Rosh, for example, said about him, V'takanosav u'gzeirosav kavuos utkuos ke'ilu nasno misinai, that his enactments and decrees are considered as if they came directly from Sinai. The next great rabbi of Chachmei Ashkenaz, as mentioned, wasn't until two generations later. That was Rashi. Rashi lived in France. Rabbeinu Gershom was in Germany. Rashi referred to Rabbeinu Gershom as Maor HaGolah, the light of the exile. Rabbeinu Gershom is also called HaGaon, Gadol HaOlam, Avi HaGolah. And in the Sefer Hayasha of Rabbeinu Tam, Rabbeinu Tam was Rashi's grandson, and he said that Mainz was a Torah center, not just in Germany, but really in Europe during the life of Rabbeinu Gershom. He writes that Rabbeinu Gershom, or HaGolah, Maor Einei HaGolah, he was the light of the eyes of the exile, the diaspora in general. V'chachmei Narbono Sfarad Shimshilofonav, and the sages of Narbonne and Spain, that they served under him. In other words, great students would study by Rabbeinu Gershom in Mainz. His father was someone named Rabbi Yehuda. His wife was Buna Bas Rav David. There are sources about him having two children, and we have evidence that one of his children actually converted to Catholicism. In the Sefer Or Zarua, in Chelek Beis, in Hilchos Avelos, Simon Tav Chav Ches, it states that Mihu Bishas Hashmad, in times of religious persecution, Shamati Mimori Harav Shimshon Zatzal, that he heard from his rabbi, the Rash Mishans, or Shimshon of Sens, who lived from 1150 to 1230, that Rabbi Gershom Nisabel Albano Kishe Nishtamed Arba'os or Yom, that Rabbeinu Gershom, that son, converted, and because of that, he mourned for 14 days. The truth is, there are differing reports about how he reacted to this conversion. The Marami Rutenberg has a tshuva on Chelek Dalad, Siman Tav Kuf Mem Dalad. And there, in that tshuva, he writes that he didn't mourn after he converted, but he writes that Rabbeinu Gershom mourned 2 weeks over his son after he died. And the Marami Rutenberg says, even though he mourned over him 2 weeks, I guess 1 week for his physical death and 1 week for, I guess, his spiritual death, that he died as a as someone who converted to Catholicism. The Ryan Rundberg said that even though Rabbeinu Gershom mourned over his son, the halacha is not like that. We don't mourn over someone who converts to Christianity, to Catholicism. Now, the Mordechai actually has a version, cites a version, that Shehemir, that the son, the Bno Hemir, im imo, that he converted with his mother, but there's no other source for this. And even the Mordechai writes that maybe this was actually not correct, he's not sure. Some scholars say or think that he may have converted during the religious persecution of 1012 when Heinrich II issued an edict of expulsion against the Jews of Mainz, but Professor Grossman, who's a major expert in this field, says that this is simply an assumption because there were a number of edicts against the Jews, and perhaps just the 1012 edict was just the most famous. Now, what's interesting is that in the Shulchan Aruch and Simon Shin Mem Seif Hei writes that if someone is a mumar lavoros kochavim, if someone converts to, to Avodah Zarah, in our case, let's say Christianity, converts to Christianity, to Catholicism, then the Rama writes, Ein misablim alav, we don't mourn over his death, citing the Mordechai. However, he says, V'yesh omrim, and some say, Shemumar shenerag bideo v'kochav misablim alav, that an individual who converted to Catholicism, but if he was killed by non-Jews, so then he achieved some kapara, some atonement, and we mourn over him. And this is based on Agos Ashri, who basically said that that's what happened with Rabbeinu Gershom. So there are really different versions of what happened with Rabbeinu Gershom's son. According to one version, he mourned over his son after he converted to Catholicism. According to another version, he mourned over his son after he died without having repented. And that was, according to that version, let's say the Mordechai, Rabbeinu Gershom acted incorrectly, but he was in a lot of pain, so we don't judge. And according to the Agos Ashri, since his son was killed by non-Jews, so that served as kapara, atonement, and he was allowed to mourn for his son. In any case, the one medieval source says that Rabbeinu Gershom came from Italy. Professor Grossman believes that he grew up in Germany, studied in Provence, southern France, and he returned to Mainz. Rabbeinu Gershom represented a new type of leader who came from the world of the sages, of the rabbis, and assumed authority by his personality and scholarship. In the era of the Gaonim, you needed, generally speaking, you needed to be someone who had yichus, to have a good lineage. You need to belong to a select group of families to become the Gaon, the leader of the Babylonian yeshiva. And Rabbeinu Sadia Gaon was an exception to the rule. He did not come from one of these families. He's probably one of the most prominent, though if not the most prominent, of the Gaonim. But he's the exception as opposed to the rule. Rabbeinu Gershom also did not come from a particular rabbinic family, rabbinic dynasty, but he was such an outstanding scholar and a personality. There's a story that's cited in the Or Zeruah when it comes to Hilchos Rosh Hashanah. It's in Chelek Beis, Hilchos Rosh Hashanah, Reish Ayin Hei, and it describes an issue that took place with, there are a lot of different rabbis, and many of them were from the Kolonimus family, And many of them were from the more mystical side, like Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, Rabbi Shmuel HaChassid. They were different, or from their, I guess from their ancestors. And there are a bunch of different Rabbanim. And the Shaila was, if there was a bris scheduled for Rosh Hashanah, do you have the bris before shofar blowing or after shofar blowing? Does shofar take precedence or does the bris mila take precedence? So all the, according to this, in this tshuva that was described here, all many different Rabbanim, Rabbeinu Gershom included, all said that the bris mila should take place before the shofar. But then, Harbeim Bnei Yeshiva Kedosha Yekasha Bnei Amlakev Tkiyas Shofar. Many of the Bnei Yeshiva had difficulty with this psak that we should delay Tkiyas Shofar for the mitzvah of Mila. They wanted to push off Mila until the end of all Tefillah. And of all the rabbis, it was Rabbeinu Gershom who said, "No, we're going to do Bris Mila before Shofar," and they listened to him. So there seems to be some evidence that he really is the final say, that he really is the leader of the community, and he's giving the final answer. As mentioned, Rabbeinu Gershom was not formally appointed, nor was he the son of an officially appointed leader. It is not known whether he held any specific communal office. He was not in close contact with the rulers, the local rulers. He did not exert any influence over them. However, he did exert influence through his learning and piety and leadership. And he used his leadership to enact communal legislation to address the needs of the public and set the stage for Chachmei Ashkenaz to do the same in subsequent generations. Not always based on the strict letter of the law, but sometimes in order to protect the life of the Kehila. One major issue that Rabbeinu Gershom had to deal with was lending with interest. There was, in his day, a tremendous demand for cash and barter and very little supply. So lending with interest was very important. In fact, Professor Grossman cites a source that sometimes interest rates were as high as 100%. Obviously, it was subject to much risk, and that's why the rates were very high. The Jews had a lot of money, as evidenced by a source from, there was a Bishop Rudiger in Speyer, and he wrote a charter in 1084, 12 years before the First Crusade, where he's trying to convince Jews to move to his town because they had a lot of money. So it was very important for Jews to be able to serve as middlemen to help facilitate financial transactions. What's the issue? Halachically, let's say that you want a loan from a Jew to a non-Jew. A Jew can lend money with interest to a non-Jew. That's not a problem. But since we hold ein shlichus la'akum, generally speaking, there's no shlichus. A Jew cannot act as an agent for a non-Jew. So let's say a Jew had a job. He was a middleman between two parties, a lender and a borrower. He was the middleman. He was the broker. So what would happen? Person A would give the money to the middleman, to the Jew, and the Jew would lend it to person B, and then person B would repay it with interest to the Jew who's the middleman, and the Jew who's the middleman would pay it to the first person. So let's say a Jew wants to lend money with interest to a non-Jew. Can a Jew be the middleman? What's the problem? Ein shlichus la'akum. And therefore, halacha, until Rabbeinu Gershom would view this loan as two separate transactions. And let's say Jew A is lending $100 to the non-Jew, but Jew B is the middleman. So Jew A is lending $100 to Jew B. Jew B is lending the $100 to the non-Jew. The non-Jew pays back with interest $150 back to Jew B. And then when Jew B gives $150 back to Jew A, that's a transaction, loan with interest, because with Jew A to Jew B, he gave him 100 and he got back 150. So that's a problem. But if we don't allow it, that's going to be a major problem for Jews to be middlemen. That was a major source of parnasa. So therefore, Rabbeinu Gershom ruled, and actually his ruling was found in Shiboli Haleket, Chelek Beis, Amud 79. And there he writes that a Jew may be a brokered a loan transaction between a Jew and a Gentile. Because even though the Jew is not the agent of the Gentile, because ain shlichos lakum, but he is the agent of the first Jew. So it's perceived as no interest is lent. You don't view it as Jew A is lending money to Jew B, who's lending it to the non-Jew, and the non-Jew is repaying to Jew B, who's repaying to Jew A. The Jew A and Jew B is the agent of Jew A. It's not that Jew A is lending money with interest to Jew B. Jew B is acting as the agent of Jew A. And therefore, it's not viewed as a loan transaction between these two Jews, and therefore it's permitted. This is just one example of Rabbeinu Gershom's halachic methodology to deal with some of the economic realities. And we're going to continue in our next session discussing other realities that Rabbeinu Gershom had to deal with. One of them, which is very prominent, was the Jews who had converted to Christianity who may have wanted to return, the idea of doing business with non-Jews during their holidays, and of course the various chevrim, the Rabbeinu Gershons that many of us are familiar with, like not marrying more than one wife at a time, not looking at someone's mail, can you force a woman to become divorced against your will. So all these rulings, enactments will be discussed in the next session.